How's it going, everybody? How's it going? Let's see if this works. Allow. How's it going? How's it going? Just keep saying it. What's up? Hello, brother. Oh, I think it's working.
Hi.
How's it going, man? Good morning.
It's going okay. How are you?
Very good. I was just messing around with the audio levels. I wanted to run a couple tests to make sure that the levels were about right, because I've had some problems with it in the past where when I listen back, one of the feeds is a lot louder than the other, basically. So just trying to fix that. But anyway, other than that, I'm good to go. How have you been since I talked to you last, man? What's new?
Oh, well, I've upgraded my audio system. I had a Shure SM58
Right.
microphone, it from my musician days. So I took it out of storage,
Nice.
and I have a preamp, Focusrite preamp, and so I plugged that in. So that should be better.
Yeah,
And
that's awesome.
just yeah, and kind of set up my lighting a little bit better to do my drawing live streams on YouTube, and I started
Oh, cool.
penciling the first page of my next comic.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So tell me about
Yeah,
when you
despite
were.
having a
Sorry, go ahead.
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, tell me about when you were in bands or whatever. Did you say you used
Oh,
to
when I
do
was in
that?
bands, Well, I was in one. It was a band called Gasm. And yeah, it was pretty interesting. Well, at least to me it was. And it's yeah, our trademark was kind of long songs.
Okay.
For us, like a 7 minute song was short. It was a short song for us.
What like type of
Yeah,
stuff was it?
so.
Like was it like prog type music or whatever?
So there are some prog elements to it, but it also had some folk, it had some metal, it had just dance.
Interesting.
We really country, we really kind of didn't really care about genre or think about it a lot. We just let our imagination go and did what sounded good to us.
Doesn't that
And
limit
so
your doesn't that kind of limit your audience though? Because you want to kind of pitch it at a certain group of people typically to get started, right?
yeah, so it limited our audience to about 30 people.
I
But
was also in a not very good local band, but it was an amazing experience for me, you know. As far as just like the I don't know, living in the back of a 12-passenger van for a while and that kind of stuff, like the all the social stuff, being with other guys and everything, it was a great, you know, great season of my life in a lot of ways. But well,
yeah.
tell
No,
me,
I'd
go
like
ahead.
to think that my band was good. We put out a couple albums.
Okay. Sorry, I
But
didn't mean to
it's
throw
not up
you
to
under
me,
the
I guess.
bus. Tell me what I guess just let's go into why you wanted to pick today's subject matter or whatever.
Oh, yeah, Metropolis, the movie.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, it was my first thought. I
Yeah.
know it's an old movie and it's an important movie in terms of like film history.
Right.
And
Yeah.
I didn't remember about it too much, but I remembered watching it and being kind of blown away back then.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, that would be a good, maybe a good one. Especially that's mostly like it's the history, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Cool. So what the way that I did it was and I don't really know how this conversation will go because I've never really done one about a like a movie or something before, so hey. But the way I did it was I read about half the book and then I watched the movie. And
Wow.
I don't know why I did it like that. But it is cool to see the overlap and the difference, I guess. I would say the the book is even weirder, kind of. And so that made the movie seem kind of like tamed, kind of. But both were super interesting. I don't think I've ever seen a silent film, all the way through before. So it was very cool on that level, just to watch anything from that long ago. Well, how do you want to talk about it? Like, do you have any particular like way you want to go through it, or do you want to just shoot the breeze? I don't really care what we do, but I'm going to let you kind of decide.
Well, how about we kind of outline what the story is?
Okay.
See if we got the same idea from the story.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
What I got is basically, so this guy, Joe Federer, who is the mastermind behind Metropolis, which is a huge, giant city in the future with a giant, super giant central tower, which is very obviously a Tower of Babel analog. And his whole concept of the city, the way it works, is that it stays basically alive and operating through the labor of the working class, who labor away at machines in the like bowels of the city, so underground. And there is so many people there underground that it's its own city. And then the son, the privileged son of the Federer guy, the mastermind of the city, encounters some of the workers who are led by a beautiful young woman who is something of an analog for the Holy Mother, mm-hmm. Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
And he is touched by this whole, basically the poor children. So he goes, follows them to the bowels of the city and realizes this whole thing, like this whole, all the wealth and the super rich are basically kind of exploiting these people.
Yeah.
So he goes on a journey of like kind of infiltrating the working class. And so that's the basic idea. That's
right.
Kind of like his journey, those characters' journeys, more or less. There's a lot more details, but that's kind of the basic premise. Is that what you got out of it?
Yeah. I do think, sorry, I'm being pedantic. I think his name is Joe Frederson.
Frederson.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
I'm thinking of the the Detroit Red Wings hockey player, Roger Federer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting angles to the story. There are a lot of biblical elements, like you mentioned, the Tower of Babel, kind of a new Tower of Babel. The fact that the woman's name is Maria is, like you said, is quite obvious. There are a lot of nods to like Mary and stuff. And then the main character is, you know, in very, very kind of like a Christ figure, I guess. There are a lot of interesting things. So when he first encounters the Maria, or when he first encounters, yeah, when he first encounters Maria, he's in this like hedonistic Garden of Eden thing that was made for the sun. So the rich sons basically have this weird place where they can go, sort of like a exclusive like little area for them where there are just like women who, you know, they can just sleep with or whatever. And because it was done in the 20s, it's quite like tasteful really, but you get the idea. And so I found it interesting that when he's in that place, he has this like face makeup on, and I think the other people there do too, as you know, as well. And so there's a lot of things in the book and the movie which talk about abstraction, the way that the lives of the, you know, of the rich in this scenario are kind of weirdly abstract. And I think the makeup is kind of a nod to that. And then so when he's there, you know, with this, in this like place with all these women or whatever, then Maria shows up, and she kind of represents like the world outside his world, his bubble, basically. And so, but there's kind of like if he wanted to, he could live in basically like an eternal adolescence. You know what I mean? Where every desire was just kind of immediately met, and he never really would have to worry about the world outside of his world. And but I think it makes it so much more gripping to him when someone shows up who, you know, who does not live that way. And so when he encounters something that is more real, it's, you know, he's kind of like struck by it. what was I going to say? I'm going to read a description really quick. Oh, a few other things about the book. When I was reading the book, I thought if I was, and I say this as a compliment, but when I was reading the book, I thought, you know, if I was ever going to start a cult, I think I would do it on this book, because it's like cool and I know that's a weird thing to say, but like it's very. I was watching a YouTube essay about the movie and all that, and they were saying that the two people who wrote, you know, the director of the movie and the person who wrote the book, come out of the expressionist movement or whatever, which doesn't mean anything to me. Like, I don't know what that means, but they were showing some like clips of it, and it makes a lot of sense. Like the book is really heavy with like image, like it's very image heavy to the point where sometimes I would read a page and be like, that was really interesting and like moving, but I have no idea what's going on in the plot. Like it kind of needs a little bit more plot. There were times when I would read a long time and not know what was going on in the story, because it's so image laden that it's almost like cryptic, sort of. It's like a little bit hard to follow. And I was reading some reviews today of people kind of trashing it on that front. But it's sort of dreamlike, I would say, and which I think is a great accomplishment, really. And when I was reading all these negative reviews of the book right before I jumped on here, I was thinking, yeah, but the people writing these negative reviews, I mean, it's not like they could ever do better. I mean, writing a bad review is saying this is trash is easy, but writing a book that, you know, puts you in a trance is not easy. And I would say that's the kind of feeling of the book, is it is very like dreamlike. But I wanted to read a description from the book on the lives of the people in the lower class. So I'm just going to read a little excerpt here. And I don't know, I just pulled a random one. I don't know if this is the best one or not, but had he ever known anything else than the horrible sobriety of these houses in which there lived not men but numbers, recognizable only by the enormous placards by the house doors? Had his life ever had any purpose other than to go out from these doors, framed with numbers, out to work, where the sirens of Metropolis howled for him, and then 10 hours later, crushed and tired to death, to stumble into the house by the door of which his number stood? Was he himself anything but a number, number 11811, crammed into his linen, his clothes, his cap? Had not the number also become imprinted into his soul, into his brain, into his blood, that he must even stop and think of his own name? So I think that's this really powerful idea that that the people in the city below, they're literally only known by their number, in the way that like a prisoner would be. And so they're kind of, you know, formally dehumanized. And so it's a really powerful image. I would say that, you know, it's kind of like, and maybe this is just to make it like dramatic, it is kind of, I don't know, it's a little like overwrought that, you know, in real life, people do have some amount of control over their life, but I think it's trying to exaggerate to make a point and to, you know, to convey a tone or whatever. If it was perfectly realistic, it wouldn't be dramatic. But it is really moving. And the other thing I was going to say is that even though it was made in 1927, it's amazing how well it does hold up, because the film and the book are so heavy with like symbolic like imagery, it doesn't really age. I mean, it ages some, but it doesn't age like other things would. And I could see I would love to see a breakdown of this movie by someone like Jonathan Peugeot or someone who thinks like in, you know, in a symbolic way like that. But let's see. So I had all these notes and everything, and then the device that the notes are on is dead, and I was running out of time. So I don't even know. I don't even know where you want to go from here.
Wing it. On the point that it holds up, I find it holds up just visually too. Yeah. Just the like the impression when I first watched the first like say maybe 20 minutes or 30 minutes, I kept kind of like losing track of the story a little bit just by being amazed by the set design, the practical effects that are, it's all, you know, you think about the technology in 1927 and there's shots in there where I'm legitimately confused at how they were able to do it because it's so, it looks like something that was done in 1973 or something. Like it's just yeah. amazing the effects.
Yeah, it's so much more advanced than I thought when you said 1927, you know?
Yeah. Let me see. And they use the set design is like very Art Deco inspired, which is quite
what does that mean?
Appropriate because Art Deco is a movement that followed Art Nouveau just after the turn of the century, the Victorian era. And it was, so Art Nouveau is sort of the philosophy of integrating the natural shapes and the natural world, shapes of plants, curves, that sort of thing, into furniture design, architecture, and so forth, and poster design. And then Art Deco was more interested in the angular shapes of man-made machines and buildings and that sort of thing. So there's Art Deco's like 20s, 30s, you can see this movie is using Art Deco to push forth this idea that the city itself is becoming the pride of man, pride in the like I guess the Christian sense, where like the all of the art and all that is abandoning the old, like abandoning, like it decoupling itself from the natural world, the created world, right. And like kind of elevating its own self as an art movement, right?
Yeah, mechanization, so. I guess, is like, kind of like one of the core themes, I guess. And this, one of the most fascinating things, okay, so we didn't get to this part of the story yet, and we won't recap plot much because I have whatever the opposite of a photographic memory is. I have a doodle memory, so the son of the most powerful man, I'm gonna jump to a different thing here for just a second. So one thing that's so fascinating about the way the book is written is the language it uses to depict like how abstract certain aspects of life are. So when it describes the father's job, who like runs the city, he's described as the brain of the city. It describes his job over and over again, and it takes certain ideas and it repeats them over and over again to make it like trance-like. But it describes his job as pressing his fingers on the blue metal plate, and it never explains it more than that, really. And so you don't really ever know what it just kind of leaves it at that. Like his job is to press his fingers on the blue metal plate. You never, and so it's just weirdly like opaque like that. But so in the story, the son falls for this woman who represents the underworld basically. And so what they do is the father has a connection with this like evil inventor guy who that scene, all of that seemed very like Frankenstein-esque.
About the evil inventor guy.
Yes.
I had a laugh at the guy's name. His name, his this guy's name's Rotwang. Did you notice that?
I was like,
this would be like a good band name for like a punk metal band or something. Yeah. Rotwang.
It sounds like I thought it was sounded like the name of a demon from that like C.S. Lewis would come up with in Screwtape Letters or something like that. But anyway, so what they do is to keep the system going kind of the way it is, the father has the evil inventor take this like robot woman that he's created and put the face of the woman the son loves on the robot and to start confusing the world as though to start confusing the society as though she's the real one. And it's fascinating the way that they tie her, the existence of, you know, artificial intelligence, for lack of a better word, to kind of the end of society. And they like formally tie it to Apocalypse, and they quote like, you know, Revelation and stuff. And I thought that was very fascinating. I thought it was, this is maybe more interesting than anything I came away with. The idea that someone in the 1920s would kind of intuitively feel that the end of a sort of mechanized society would essentially be artificial intelligence of some kind. That 100 years ago, someone could feel that this was coming. You know what I mean? Like, that is so fascinating to me.
Well, it fits in well the whole elevation of man theme, right? Mm. The because that's what the Rotwang is kind of his goal, like of making a machine to replace man, or making a machine in the image of man, I guess. So yeah. It's sort of like Earth. It's the pride of Satan that wants to be as God, right?
Yeah, and it makes so much sense, but it's just so fascinating that I don't know that someone could see it coming like that, I guess. And what was I about to say? I don't know what I was about to say. Hold on, let me think about what I was about to say.
You're talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Okay. So then yesterday or a few days ago, I've started this book by Rene Girard called Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the Earth. I think that's what it's called. But Rene Girard is this like anthropologist or whatever who came up with the his big like discovery was something called mimetic theory, which is a theory of humanity which basically outlines how much of it is driven by the human desire to mimic each other, basically, and that it's essentially it's responsible for all art. It's responsible for violence. Like, for example, like if two people want the same woman, they can't both have her, obviously, so they fight over her, violence, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, he outlines this whole like theory of humanity on that basis. He was a Catholic thinker, and he died, I want to say he died in like 2008 or something, but anyway, so I was starting that book. It's one of those books that you're like, if I understand any of this, I'm going to learn a lot, but I don't know how much I'll really get. So anyway, so I was starting that, and he started to talk about trying to understand these really old religions on their own, by their own like frame of reference to the world, not ours. So rather than judging them as stupid and old, try to think of how they thought. And so he talked about how something that we see as weird and dumb and superstitious about certain religions way back in the day is they would have like a fear and a sort of like demonic fear of things like mirrors and twins. And so he talked about the reason that he believed that they would fear something like a mirror or a twin was that they kind of intuitively felt that there was a correlation between violence and mimicry. So when two people, you know, become violent with each other, they end up kind of being mirrors of each other. They end up being very similar in as far as what they're doing. They're obviously opponents, but they become more alike than they would be if they were not in that violent situation. And so there became this like association that when things are mimicked, that we are in the sort of neighborhood of violence and of danger. And he talked about how it was seen as twins, for example, or mirrors or whatever, that mimicry was seen as a kind of dangerous magic. And so when I first heard that, I thought, what? Like, that makes, at first that made no sense to me. But then I started thinking about deep fakes, and that, you know, then that makes perfect sense to me after thinking of it in that context, that a deep fake is, you know, you could take anyone's face and make them say or do anything, and eventually, like soon, you'll be able to realistically make it look like they did or said a number of things they did not do, obviously. So you can manipulate the world, you know, by mimicking someone. And then I started to understand what he was meaning by saying that that a kind of false version of someone can be a kind of dangerous thing. And I just thought that was an interesting unintentional tie-in to the movie, because the ideas of the movie, you know, are heavily tied up in that there's a great danger in man making a false version of everything because it, you know, kind of pleases him to do so. And one of the YouTube essays I watched on this movie was talking about how both groups are sort of dehumanized. So the poor people are dehumanized because they're all kind of slaves, and they're, you know, they're known by a number, not their name, and their lives are completely uniform. And when you see them, when you see their jobs and the way everything about their life is completely uniform, nothing, there's no individuality. And so in that way, they're completely, you know, dehumanized. And then he showed other clips where the robot, you know, woman had come to life and was basically, you know, drawing the sexual attention of all the rich guys. And visually, the way the movie is made, they all come to start doing the same things as each other as well. So there's a kind of uniformity among the rich people because of their, the rich men, because of their uniform desire. And so he was showing how in both cases, some kind of evil is removing the humanity of all the groups, that the rich are being, you know, dehumanized by their lust, and the poor by their, you know, by being controlled. And I thought that was a really good like read of the way that the story works. One other thing on the movie, I think it could have easily gone into a really kind of oversimplistic rich people bad, poor people good thing, and it doesn't really it doesn't really do that. And this is just a kind of inconvenient truth that happens to be true. Like, I know some rich people that have a very, what to me seems like a very appropriate relationship to money. And I know some poor people that are extremely greedy. So that's just how that works, you know? And you know, there's the other also exists, obviously, but this kind of oversimplified, progressive vision that if you're rich, you're evil, if you're poor, you're kind of saintly or whatever, is just not true. And the movie, I think, doesn't fall into that. It does something more, you know, nuanced than that. And like, so there's a part where the poor people basically abandon the machines they work in. And it's acknowledged that if they abandon these machines, like, the world will fall apart. And so there's a certain acknowledgement that, that there is something gained by mechanization as well, and there certainly is. And you know, it's very, I don't know, especially these days, it's quite like trendy to talk about how bad modern life is because it's making us very homogenized and all that. And I'm one of those people that talks about that because it does concern me. Like, I feel like we are becoming more homogenized, and we're dealing with a weird kind of depression that's associated with that. So it is a thing. But it's kind of like, it's sort of like a problem you only have if your nation is reasonably rich. Like, really poor countries don't have that problem, but they do have a bunch of other problems. And so, you know, some gratitude for the system as it is, you know, is called for. Like, I don't know. I mean, not everything about, you know, our world is great, but I like, I don't know. I like Panda Express or whatever. I don't know. I like lots about it. And it's not all bad all the way down, you know? And one concern I have.
It's all worth it for Panda Express.
I would say the concern I have, one of the biggest concerns I have for the future generally, is just that it seems like, to me, we're moving away from a model where the economy is a bunch of a million small businesses and towards it being a few corporations, you know? And that really, that very, very much scares me because that's a dangerous, dangerous thing. So I don't know what you do about that, really, but that is a really, really terrifying prospect, because I think so much goodness and human happiness is derived by, you know, it being made up of a bunch of different people doing their thing and having, you know, their little businesses or whatever. If we're all driven by like five big companies or whatever, that's a very scary thing in my view. Especially when you see the way that they kind of, you know, kiss up to the government or whatever, and then play, you know, in each other's hand and all that. That's just like terrifying, kind of. So I don't know what you do about that. I try not to worry about stuff you can't do much about. But there's something to be worried about there for sure, that we're, you know, that we're moving away from a model of upstarts to, you know, a sort of corporate absolutist model. Although I did hear someone say not long ago that the 1950s was a very centralized time as far as a business and stuff. So maybe we've been through it before and survived it before. But anyways, yeah, anything else you want to mention on the movie or whatever?
Yeah. So Metropolis, the movie, its answer to that is, it's a little on the nose the way they do it, but I mean,
yeah,
they come from a background of theater, right. So it's kind of meant to be like cartoonish a little bit, right? All the acting's kind of cartoony, but their big moment, climactic moment, is big orchestral music and the words on the screen come up. The mediator of the heart and the hand. No, the mediator of the head and the hand is the heart. So basically, you know, love is supposed to be solving this problem of the class tension.
Yeah. And another thing that's
how the movie deals with that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It is a bit overt. But on the other hand, because it's a silent film, obviously there's very, you know, there's no dialogue or whatever. It did make me think, man, there is too much dialogue in modern movies. Like, modern movies would be better if they did force themselves to show more of what they wanted to get across rather than say it, you know? And so I think there is something to that, to forcing yourself to make it image heavy. And there's a scene with all the eyeballs where it's like, kind of like a, I don't
oh,
know.
Oh, yeah.
That scene, I'm amazed they pulled that off in the 20s. That could be in like a modern,
super,
you know,
creepy.
Yeah. yeah. So what was I going to say? So when there's a part in the movie where the, right before it's flooded or whatever, there's a part in the movie where all the, you know, like lower class people or whatever, I believe they're all just like being kind of driven by this sort of demonic fake, you know, woman who's, I guess, like a sort of sex robot type thing. And there's a scene where the little card cuts in, because occasionally there'll be a card that has some dialogue on it to move the story forward. And there's a scene where it said, where like two people look at each other and one goes, where are your children? And there's this idea that that when adults overly give in to, you know, hedonism or whatever, that children are the first to suffer, basically. And I also found it fascinating that the poor people have more kids than the rich people do, which seems true. To mirror our
true,
world
actually,
as well.
Yeah, in the upper stratas above, there are no children at all.
Yeah, yeah, and wow. There are. You know, there are.
That.
I guess technically there are, because the dudes in the Garden of Delights or whatever, they're technically the sons, but they're all grown. There are no actual children.
There's no little kids. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like nodding at the way that their life is to, you know, to be like an abstract brain which controls the world that has very little tolerance for the messiness or, you know, humanity of having a child or whatever, you know, and our whole world is kind of moving that way. We see children as like a thing which would make us less efficient or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're weirdly becoming, you know, similarly kind of dehumanized, and it's almost like, yeah, the father is described as the brain of the city. And so I think they do a good job of depicting the way that he is great at what he's great at, but is extremely limited in other ways. And that we're becoming weirdly, yeah, we just don't, as it pertains to children, we just don't really see a use for them. We don't, because we kind of want to live in the, we want to live in their, in the Eden they depict. Like, we want to live in a place of just eternal youth and like, you know, hedonistic, you know, sex or whatever. Like, that's like the modern idea of like heaven or whatever. So, and I don't think we've fully thought through that if you did get there, then you'd start to see the emptiness of it, I guess. And I think we, maybe as a culture, we are starting to see the emptiness of it. That, you know, it's good for what it's good for, but it can't give you anything other than that. Like, it is limited. And, you know, pleasure is limited to a certain extent that, you know, it's not something to die for necessarily. And I was thinking about this yesterday. This is a little bit off topic, but not really. Yesterday I was listening to an old Flyleaf song called Cassie, and it's about this woman and Columbine shooting who was a believer and was murdered for, you know, for being a Christian, basically. And so the song is about that. It's a powerful song. And basically she was asked, you know, if she believed in God or whatever, and she told the shooter that she did, and they killed her. And I was thinking about how, obviously, it's very dark on one front, but that in another way, the darkness of the average person's life is that they don't feel like they ever get a chance to make a decision that really matters like that. Like, on one hand, you'd never want to be in her shoes to be forced to, you know, be at gunpoint. But in a different way, she was making this, like, monumental decision, and this, like, decision of ultimate significance that she was, with her very life, like, voting for, you know, the existence of a goodness outside of humanity. And that what's so soul-destroying about the average person's life is that they don't feel like they'll ever even be asked something that really matters, that they'll just wake up every day, live and die without having once being even given the chance to make a decision that felt like it really meant something. And I'm not necessarily saying that's true, but it is like the feeling of living in a weirdly, in a world where, you know, pleasure is one of the only things sought because it's basically the only thing left. Like, people don't really believe that life necessarily does have any meaning. And if it doesn't, then pleasure would be, you know, the natural next thing. Like, you know, why would you think of anything else? And, And so that also shows why we don't we don't want to think about aging. Like, we don't want to get old. Like, we're scared of getting old, and we don't necessarily like people that are old because they remind us that we might get old and that kind of stuff. You know, there's a certain fear of getting old and dying and all that. Like, modern sort of social ethics are very, because they're very sex heavy, they're very, you know, they're naturally youth oriented. I don't know how they work after you're not young and hot or whatever. I don't know what you're supposed to, I guess you're supposed to, once you're not hot, you're supposed to just kill yourself. I don't know. I don't know exactly. Oh. I don't really know what you're supposed to do, but anyway, the way the movie talks about meaning and, you know, in class and all that stuff is really fascinating. And because it is so image heavy, it ages super well. And it's one of those things that I think, you know, I don't know. I think 100 years from now, it might still be quite like gripping because it's the images are like symbolic images. They're not really things that will age, you know? And it's a really fascinating thing on that front. I also, it's a little off topic, but I like watching, I haven't started till recently, but I like watching old movies because I feel different about, I just feel different overall when I experience something from the past that has had impact that I wasn't aware of. Like, I don't really know how else to explain it, but it's sort of like I feel more tied to my, you know, culture or something when I am a little bit more aware of what made it, you know what I mean? And I don't know exactly how, but I know a lot of movies I do love currently, like, owe some kind of debt to this movie, you know? And yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly how. I will say yesterday I went to see Dune Part 2, which is incredible. It's amazing, really. And it's very, there is some overlap in that with this movie that religion plays a huge part, like kind of the central role in Dune Part 2. And so the way that there's a kind of mixture between, I don't know, a science fiction framework and a story where religion is really heavily, like, you know, where the two play together is still going on, obviously. And I guess that's because even though we live in a very scientific era, we're still, humanity on the whole is quite, you know, religious, even if you try not to be. And which I don't, but, you know, it's just one of those things that will never die. And so there's some, yeah, when watching it, I thought, I don't know what, but a bunch of stuff, this has impacted a bunch of stuff that I like. And it's now cool to see, like, I don't know, see the, like, granddad of things that I like, you know, or something like that. Anything else on that? Or do you want to, we can just talk about whatever. What have you been thinking about? This is a question I asked my friend the other day. What has been plaguing your thoughts lately?
Oh boy. I can tell you're heading into the right profession by going to school to become a therapist with a question like that.
How does that make you feel?
Let me see. I guess I have a hard time trusting people.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why I have a hard time trusting God. Mm. I believe in God. I think I find it's easy to believe in God. To me, it seems like pretty obvious. I mean, it's really the only tenable explanation for anything. Yeah. But believing in God and believing in goodness, I find are two different things. and so that's what I've been working on. I did find, so I had told you the story of how I kind of came to end up where I am, which is, you know, sort of in the Catholic realm, but, you know, one day at a time with that. Mm-hmm. But my brother, took the time to listen to my story, and I realized it was the first time in my family where anybody listened to anything I had to say until the end. And wow. It was such a relief, and it helped me with this. It helped me with the faith side of things. It helped me kind of open up a little bit. Mm. Yeah. So I think a lot of it has to do with the whole trust thing. It has to do with understanding that there are ways you can make a contribution. That those things seem to be linked, because it's because I grew up in like a religious Christian fundamentalist cult. It was always the only thing you have is your contribution that will always be insufficient. Mm. So you have to keep giving, 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 and you cannot keep anything, right? But in the as I understand it, in the actual Christianity, you can trust God to make it so that you're enough to make a contribution that matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you don't have to kill yourself. You know, some people do, but. You know, the whole martyrdom thing. But the idea is that there's like small people in the Bible that
right.
do things, and then it ends up that it matters, and it was just because they trusted God. I don't know. These thoughts are still all new to me, so I'm not too sure what to make of them.
Well, yeah, I'm right there with you, and I appreciate. I'm so glad you said all that, because you know, a couple of months ago or whatever, when I got the diagnosis with my eyes or whatever, I mean, I kind of felt like, all right, well, I really don't want to have like some crisis of faith or whatever, just because it's cliche and that feels like bad taste to me, but I don't like doing it because it's cliche, but it's sort of, you know, it's kind of happening anyway. And so I really resonate with what you're saying about, you know, believing there is a God is kind of intuitive, but believing that he's good is a very different question. And, you know, for me personally, I have somewhat similar background, not exactly obviously, but the way that I understood God growing up was something like, you have grace as long as you don't ever need it. And if you ever need it, you won't have it. But if you don't need it, you'll have as much as you could ever need. And it was sort of like, my takeaway was, we don't believe in grace at all, really. Like, that's like, it's like a thing we put on the sign, but we don't believe in it. That's not like, what we really believe in is a kind of moral pissing contest. And the status associated with moving up the, you know, the moral perfection hierarchy, and that's what we believe in. And so, you know, grace is a thing that we just don't believe. Now, we never stop talking about it, but we don't believe it. And so that was my, you know, takeaway. And my dad, you know, my father was he could be kind of tyrannical at times, and I knew he loved me very much. So that sent a similar kind of message, that the person who loves you most is a bit, you know, unpredictable. And, you know, so the two kind of fed each other. And I think that's quite natural. Like, a lot of people tend to view God with similar flaws to their earthly dad or whatever. And I don't say this in too much judgment of my dad, because, like, if I had a son right now, it would not be, I would mess him up in various ways. So I'm not really on any kind of pedestal. I knew that he did, you know, he did what he could at that time. And the older I get, like all of us, the older I get, the more I appreciate what he did do, and what he did well. And those were not small or, you know, insignificant things. So I want to have a lot of gratitude as well. But so at church, I didn't really, grace didn't seem like a thing, like a real thing. And then at home, it, you know, there was some grace at home, but it, but dad was both loved me very much and was quite, you know, angry a lot and kind of unpredictable and stuff. So they fed each other. And what I come to realize over the years about the Christianity I grew up in, and not to diss on that either, part of the reason that I still consider myself a Christian is that, I mean, there are a lot of reasons, but one of them is that even when it wasn't great, I would look, you know, out at the world at people who weren't involved at all, and I would think, well, these people, you know, these church people have something. They have something worth keeping, and I don't know exactly what it is. There's a goodness to them, and so I don't want to just throw it out. And if God does exist, then disbelieving him would be, you know, not that different from disbelieving like the sun or whatever. It's just like it's not gonna do anything to him. So anyway, but what I came to believe about the way I understood religion is that the church I grew up in was extremely individualistic. It was very like, in a weird way, it was extremely heavy on individualism. So moral perfection was kind of moved to the top because the individual was moved to the top. And so I understand that. I understand the goodness of that. But in practice, it made God sort of appear, that God became like someone who was like similar in size to me, but just really, really hard to impress, but relatively small. And because the way that, again, the way that people would talk about Christianity and faith and all that was as if, the way I grew up, they would all talk about it as if it was very simple and straightforward, and they totally understood it, and, you know, everyone else was just wrong for not understanding it. As if it was all simple, and that just didn't make sense to me. Like, if it is God, it may be a lot of things, but it wouldn't be like, wouldn't be that simple. If anything, it's a bit more respectful to think that, you know, you could live and die and spend your whole life to get a glimpse of it, and that seems much. That depicts God as much bigger. It depicted God as small and easily understood. And you know, you're basically like a rat in a hamster on a wheel, and that's how I understood it. So I tried to have a kind of moral perfection, and even if you do it for the wrong reason, sometimes a lot of good things happen. Like there's a lot good about my life because of, you know, the way I tried to live, and God bless that, you know. I have a very, I'm not saying this in a weird way, I'm just blessed by it. I have a, you know, very positive reputation and that kind of thing, and I'm very blessed by that. And certainly all the people I grew up with and all of their problems, I mean, a lot of them are you know, to blame for the good things in my life. So I want to be merciful. And even now I don't, you know, I'm not in some place where I have come to some new thing that, you know, where I didn't have the answers, but I do now. It's that's not really it. But I wanted to read to you. I've been going through Ecclesiastes, you know, one of the books of the Old Testament written by Solomon, and it's very dark. It reads almost like Kierkegaard or some like dark, like existentialist type, you know, character. And I came across this verse. Actually, let me give you a little bit more context, even though I'm talking a lot. So the shame that I would have for, let's say, 20 years maybe, the shame that I would have over a lack of moral perfection would become so intense that I would start to feel kind of suicidal, that I was I would say I was relatively suicidal about once a week from maybe 15 to 25. And so here's how the logic would work. It would usually be something like sexual or something like that. So here's how the logic works. I would think, all right, I'm trying really hard to do right in this area. I still can't seem to be, perfectly on the up and up. And everyone else I know isn't trying at all. So if I'm trying really hard and I'm still kind of doomed, then all the people I know who don't care at all, they're definitely doomed. And if I'm doomed and they're doomed, then, then we're doomed. And then how is any of this good news? And so those dominoes would kind of fall, one after the other. And I would come to feel that sort of existing itself, that I would wake up, and I don't know, I still kind of do, but I would wake up every day just with this like intense feeling of guilt that I, just for kind of being here. And there's a certain kind of narcissism in that, right? There's a certain kind of self deification to think that anything about you is so important that you should feel that kind of responsibility. But that's how I understood it. I only knew what I knew. And so because I knew God as a thing to pretty much as a thing to, impress who was kind of always waiting to throw you away, that's how I understood it. And so yeah, so I would just feel like my existence was kind of, I don't know, I would feel that it, maybe were better had it not been or something like that. And even now, and I'm trying to like come out of this, but even now when I hear someone, and this is a weird thing to say, and I don't know that I'd say it to everyone, but even now when I hear someone, pass away, I feel relieved, I don't feel sad. And I mean, I guess if it were someone real close to me, I'd feel sad, but I feel weirdly relieved, And I don't say, I'm not, I don't know. I know that's weird, but I want to have a faith in the goodness of God, which is so durable that no matter what I go through, that I always choose that existence is worth the trouble, But I wanted to read one verse that I came across the other day, which is directly ties into all of this. Let me see if I can find the thing. Okay, so this is from Ecclesiastes, and I won't read the whole thing. This is a really short verse. So Solomon, who had lots of wives and all the rest, concubines and all that, I don't know. I'm not super into his like sex life or whatever, but he did say somewhere that he did not deprive himself of any earthly pleasure. And given that he was one of the, I think he was like the richest person on the earth, I think we can take him quite literally in on that account. But after all that, he said, "Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself?" And I had never heard that before. This idea that if you take on too much of the role of God internally, like if you associate yourself, as too close to Him, that you will kind of start to rip yourself apart. And that, and so I spent years and years in that place where I would try to think myself too highly and then kind of self-destruct when I couldn't get there, and then just do that over and over again. And that was my life. And so when I would try to, when I would try to date or something like that, I would have when I did try to date, I would eventually find out that this wound that I had between me and God, the way that I understood him as a thing who was always like on the edge of throwing me away, that, I would naturally try to get, the girl or whoever to make me not feel like that. And that doesn't work that good, as you might guess. Because they're not, no one is in a role to fix something that central, you know? So if you just keep drilling down, I had this kind of, I had this feeling that God did not want me, and maybe did not want us. And that once you believe that more than you believe anything else, it's very hard to know, it's very hard to not try to get someone to, you know, paper over the cracks. One other thing, and then I promise I'll stop talking. One other thing that I think a lot about, because I've been really, it's fascinating that you said what you did, because of how similar, you know, my position is, I guess, and what I've been thinking about. One thought I've had the other day was that in the Bible somewhere, it says that every man is given a measure of faith. And that obviously implies that some are given less than others. And I am experimenting with the idea that perhaps artists are given a little bit less than some others, because part of our role as an artistic person is that we create things because we feel a certain gap. And I think the artist lacks something that the non-artist has, and so we try to build things to kind of understand certain things about the world. And maybe that is just the way it is. Like, maybe the artist is given a smaller measure of faith than some others, and that is a, you know, a kind of motivator towards creating things. And I'm not saying that's like canon or anything. That's just something I've been thinking about. But it could be. And, you know, if every man is given a measure of faith, and that meaning that some people are given more or less, then that would indicate that what matters is not how much you have, but what you do with however much you have. You know, like, I've never necessarily felt like I had a great deal. I've always been on the cynical edge, and I don't say that to be like, you know, cool and edgy or whatever. It's not. So some parts of it are so like soul destroying that they would be gotten rid of if possible, you know. But that whatever I do have, whatever amount I do have, that may my will be towards the good, regardless of the cards I'm holding. You know, that may I will the good.
Very deep.
Well, we could talk about whatever you want. I don't know. I like your drawing. I know people can't see it, so I won't talk about it too much, but tell me how you're doing the shading. So that, like, are you shading some parts more than others because to show like where the sunlight would be, I guess?
Or there's a couple of things. There's lighting, and then there's depth. Create depth, so the mountains that are further back should have more shading that it doesn't look just like a wall of mountains. It looks like layers of mountains.
Yeah.
And then composition. So you should shade or create more darkness around certain. So there's a dude at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So I shaded in the sign so that your eyes drawn towards that guy, because he's the thing that's kind of important in the scene. Mm. So the composition, depth, lighting. What was it in graphic design school? It was, the acronym was CRAP: contrast, repetition, alignment, proximity. Yeah.
So you went to graphic design school.
Yeah, I got my graphic design degree, I guess. Technically not a degree, but it's the equivalent of a degree. It's like certification, I guess.
Yeah, I've always been super interested in it. I tried to go to this college near my house years ago for it, and they didn't offer it. But if I weren't going blind, I would definitely do it, because I don't know why, but I'm just like inherently kind of interested in graphic design. And if things were different with my eyes, I would definitely you know, try to make money off it and stuff, because it's such a cool thing to know. Have you, is it, I'm sure I asked you this already in one of the previous conversations. Do you use it in like your job and stuff? Have you ever done that with it, or is it just a skill you have, I guess?
I started my career doing newspapers, layouts and ads.
Oh, cool.
And then, when I moved across the country, I had a hard time getting back in because I moved to a town that had a graphic design, like a famous graphic design college. So I was competing with all these junior designers willing to work for peanuts, whereas I had, 7 years experience. So I switched to working in property management, and I'm still doing that. And now I'm pretty stable in that career. I've been doing it, 12-ish years. So I'm going back to drawing and just getting back my chops. But I prefer drawing with traditional media. I am doing graphic design works I drew the map of the world that I'm doing this comic in, but I put it in Photoshop in order to create a GIF that kind of introduces you to the different provinces and stuff. So like I mix it a little bit, but definitely prefer working in traditional media, which is kind of like the feature of my Substack. You know, it's a guy working in traditional media instead of digital. So
yeah, that's cool. I'm sure I asked you all that before, but well, is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I'm good. I think we did the rounds and everything, and we understand everything now. It's great.
The universe is sorted.
Exactly.
I'm not going to lie. I feel like I did a terrible job of explaining the movie. I don't know. We were like, there's some guys, and they did some stuff, and I guess you should watch it. Speaking of which, I will put the movie's on YouTube, which is cool. So I'm going to put the description to, or the, link to the movie in the description if you do want to watch it and have more big brain thoughts than we did. But I hope you got something out of it. And the book is also very interesting. It was $3 on Kindle if you're fascinated by it. I think the book is somehow even kind of more interesting. Although, because there's not... Like, after about 5 hours, I was like, all right, I get it. We're done. Like, just get to the point. And I think it would be better if it were, like, half as long, probably. But if you're the type of person that, for whom a, like, dreamlike sci-fi book sounds good, then I think you would absolutely love it. Well, dude, thanks for making the time with all this. And, I guess I'll hit you up in about a month or something, and we'll just go from there. And have a great day, dude. Great to talk to you.
Same to you. Have a good weekend.